The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Everyone, welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your fullest and healthiest life. In its 70 years, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has evolved from a malaria control program to an institution dedicated to improving health for all people across the world. Today, I have the incredible honor of being joined by its former director and public health luminary, Dr. William Fagy. In his career, Dr. Fagy has been a part of pivotal movements in public health, including eradication of smallpox in the late 1970s and the discovery of Legionnaire's disease, Reye syndrome, toxic shock syndrome, and HIV/AIDS. From threats of terrorist attacks to congressional hearings to tensions in the field, Dr. Fagy has behind-the-scenes insight into the biggest successes in public health and lessons learned for overcoming crises and improving the health of our nation. Dr. Fagy was the director of the Centers for Disease Control between 1977 to 1983. He was the president and co-founder of the Task Force for Global Health from 1984 to 1999, senior fellow of the Global Health Program for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, executive director of the Carter Center from 1986 to 1992, and continues to serve as health policy fellow for the Carter Center. He's Emeritus Presidential Distinguished Professor of International Health at Emory University. Dr. Fagy is also the author of House on Fire, The Fight to Eradicate Smallpox, published in 2011, and The Fears of the Rich, The Needs of the Poor, My Years at the CDC, published in 2018. In 2012, he was awarded Presidential Medal of Freedom. Dr. Fagy, I'm so honored to have you here today. What I want to do is begin by getting your perspective and philosophy about public health. You know, people in public health do it not for the external thank you, but more the internal thank you. And, you know, for people that want to go into public health, do you think that that is still going to be the predominant outcome, or I guess career satisfaction, or do you think that public health for the people who are providing it will have other ways of recognizing people that are literally saving lives of millions of people behind the scenes?
Well, it's interesting that as a society we say we value certain things, but it's not where we put our money. And the way we pay teachers, the way we pay mental health workers, social workers, public health workers, it shows that we have lip service. And I think prevention is a word that everyone likes to use but not fund. And it's true for individuals and for states and for nations. We don't actually value health until we lose it, and then it's like the old saying that you learn about geology the day after the earthquake. And that's what happens. We have a crisis and then we learn something about it. But, you know, I continue to be very optimistic. When I was in medical school, and over 60 years ago, I couldn't find, at the University of Washington, I could not find three people interested in global health. But I found one. And he's still alive today, and I had a chance to introduce him last year at a Gates Foundation annual meeting as I talked about mentors and the role of mentors. And then I talked about him as a mentor and said that he returned to Seattle to retire. And I said, the amazing thing is he's still alive, but even more amazing, he's in this room. And with that, he stood up and the spotlight went on, you know, and it was a very nice completing of a circle. So. At that time, I couldn't find people interested. Now, global health has become one of the great drawing cards for students in almost every university. And at Emory School of Public Health this year, their new class includes 170 people from other countries. I mean, it's just, who would have believed that that would happen in such a short period of time? So I think we'll still be getting people interested in this, as evidenced by that's what they want to get into. Years ago, I sent a memo to Dr. Laney with four suggestions on medical school at Emory. And I said, number one, it's very hard to really imbue a 20-year-old with a new philosophy. It's something that starts earlier than that. And so number one suggestion was find people who already have demonstrated their interest in social causes and recruit from that group. Number two, make it clear that it's important to Emory because medical students were seeing patients at Grady, and every school does that. Make it clear that this is part of our social interaction. It's not just something that we use poor people in order to train them. It's part of our social. Number three, make sure that they have an experience during medical school in another culture. Mm-hmm. And number four, make sure that everyone that graduates from medical school at Emory has an MD degree and an MPH degree, because then you've equipped them for both the numerator and the denominator. And so I think we will see more of that already at Emory. Quite a number of the students get both degrees, and I'm told every year that they're some of the best students in the class. It's not the dregs of society that are doing this. So I'm very hopeful about people seeing this as important. And you know, every cohort has people interested in how do you improve the future. It's not all how do we make money, but it goes to a question you asked earlier about philosophy. And I tell students, don't spend time on the life plan because you can't possibly know the opportunities that will come to you. And spend that time instead on a life philosophy. And then you'll have tools for every fork in the road for making your decisions. And I tell them that they should be thinking in terms of their personal philosophy and their professional philosophy. With the personal philosophy, I've over the years used a seminar technique with high school students, college students, graduate students, where I say to them, you're 30 years old, you have $1 million. What will you spend the entire million on? You can't divide it up. And you know, the interesting thing is they can't think of anything. And so they start out with a blank. And then I give them scenarios. Your child's been kidnapped. For $1 million, you can get your child back. Well, some of them play games, you know, which child and that sort of thing. But it comes
your favorite child.
Yes. But it comes down to, of course they would do that. They would give up. They'd be willing to be poor the rest of their life to get their child back. So I said, okay, you've established one thing more important than money, and that's a relationship. And I say, at the end of this hour, you're going to have a list of priorities more important than money in priority order. And of course, they don't believe you can do that. So then I give them another scenario. You've just been told that you have 3 months to live, but for $1 million, you could buy a normal life expectancy. And of course they would do that. So I said, okay, now health is more important than money. So you have health and relationships. And then I start bargaining with them. What if you could only buy 20 years? Would you still spend $1 million? 10, 5, you get to a point where they all will not pay $1 million. And why? They would rather leave that money for their spouse and children. So I said, okay, it's health and relationships now. But then I go on. It's not your fault, but you've been given a life sentence in jail. But for $1 million, you could get out. Would you rather be a millionaire in jail, or are you willing to be poverty-stricken the rest of your life and be free? And of course, freedom. Okay, so now freedom's on the list. I tell them that they have a gift, whether it's a musical gift or intellectual gift, but they can't use it unless they're willing to give up their $1 million. And so we get a list of 6 or 7 things. And if they have 7 things, I say the rules have just changed. You can only have 6. Which one will you drop off? and then you can only have five, four. And so at the end of an hour, they actually have a list of things in their life more important than money. And when you think of how much school and experience pushes you towards the way we measure success is money, this really turns out to be a revelation that they're willing to give that up for certain things. And then I go into, okay, the philosophy for your profession. And I say, I think it's very important to try to be a generalist and a specialist simultaneously. A generalist so that you know how the world operates and works and see the problems, see the things that work. And then a specialty where your passion is so strong you'll never want to retire. But now you know how that specialty in fact changes the general. You can see the interaction and what difference it makes. So I think these turn out to be important things to try to get even before people get into medical school. It's the same problem I've had with ethics. You just cannot teach ethics by the time people are graduate students. And how do you get that early on? Now we have at Emory, as you may know, the first endowed chair in global health ethics of any place in this country for sure, but maybe in the world. And we got this just 2 years ago with the Hilton Foundation. And so, you know, it's a start there with all these big global problems. How do you insert ethics into this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so happy to, you know, talk about your, you know, experiences through your career and how you pass that on to your trainees and how the mentors in your life have influenced you. And what's fascinating is, you know, reading about your life path, just as you mentioned, and, you know, one of my absolute, favorite lines in your book is life plans are an illusion. And it's such a beautiful line, really outlining, you know, first of all, what you just said about finding your priorities, but the corollary is not planning your life, right? Because you're helping your trainees build a philosophy and not a true plan. And how your own career, you didn't plan on being the director of the CDC, but it evolved as a progression of just confluence of influences in your life and how they've directed you. And when you think of, you know, first, if you wouldn't mind, talk about how the role of just having a philosophy rather than a plan allowed you to be taken in the direction that it took you, as opposed to, you know, some people are so structured and have such a rigid plan that they almost overlook opportunities. And you know, kind of there's a downside to that. And if you could comment on how that's played a role in your life, why you think it's so valuable for people to maybe be open to just a general philosophy?
The first thing is that when you see how much you learn over time, it's sort of ridiculous to think that at 17 or 18, you might know enough to know what you want for the rest of your life. And I have to admit that I was not very good at finding mentors deliberately. They just came. And I was so lucky. Six of my mentors at one point were over 90 years of age, so I kept in contact with them. One of them made it to 100. And the first one was Ray Ravenholt. The first one in graduate school was Ray Ravenholt, but I had one in college who was so good. He looked like a German scientist with white wavy hair. He looked like Einstein. He would start lecturing before he got to the lecture hall. And so people were listening as he came down the hall, and you'd hear him talking, but he was actually lecturing. He'd walk in and he would start writing on the blackboard with both hands simultaneously, different things. And I think I got interested in biology because I wanted to be able to do that. And then you find out it has nothing to do with biology. So One of my mentors turned out to be Tom Weller. And I went to Harvard just on the basis of an article I read in the New England Journal. And I was so dumb, I didn't even know he was a Nobel laureate. I read that article and I thought, oh, I need to get more of this. And so I applied and spent a year with him. So I was fortunate in getting mentors like that. I think three of the mentors that I think about were Nobel Prize laureates. And I wasn't smart enough to find them, but I'm smart enough now to tell students how to find them. I tell students, find someone that really encapsulates what you would like to be or do or believe, and ask them a question in their field. And then go back 2 weeks later with a follow-on question that they know you actually heard what they said. And by the time you've done that three times, you have a mentor, whether they want it to be or not. Because the people that you want as a mentor are so busy, they're not looking for mentees. But you can trick them into being a mentor by your interest in what they're doing.
Yeah, that's actually great advice. And you know, within that is also the idea that you don't have to have one mentor, but multiple, and learn through multiple people, because there's probably not going to be one that encapsulates everything you want to be, and people are busy.
Exactly.
When I'm listening to you say how fortunate you are to have had six great mentors, to me, you know, there's always a push and pull, and what you have omitted, your failure of omission, is your ability to create the type of relationship that stays intact until these mentors are 90 years old, right? A lot of people don't invest in the relationship, and it's to your credit to have made that investment, right? It's almost like you get out what you put in, and your investment into these people and that relationship has led to a lifelong mentorship, you know, mentor-mentee that I'm sure over the years has toggled back and forth.
Exactly, exactly. And some of my mentees are now my mentors. So that's exactly what happened. Tom Weller, who was the Nobel laureate at Harvard, he got his Nobel Prize for growing poliovirus in the lab, which made the Salk and Sabin vaccines possible. And once you got to know him, he would admit he wasn't trying to do that. He was trying to grow chickenpox virus. And he had been studying what kind of nutrients might do this. And he came up with a new medium, and he had his flasks, and he inoculated them with different chickenpox strains. And he had three flasks left over, and he almost poured them down the drain, and then he decided, well, he wouldn't do that. So he put in some polio. The chickenpox never grew, and he was surprised to see the polio was growing. And so it was favoring the prepared mind, of course, but that's not what he was looking for. Well, I gave the commencement address at the Harvard School of Public Health the year he retired. And in my address, I pulled out that New England Journal of Medicine article, and I read several of the sentences that had forced me to go to Harvard. Well, his wife told me that he was just so pleased with that. And they would go miles to hear me talk after that. And she would let me know they were coming so that I could include that story. And she said, you know, he takes credit for everything you've ever done.
And it speaks to the nature of mentor-mentee relationships, right? It's, you know, it seems to me that you haven't approached mentors as how they can help you, but equally as how you can help them. And it's interesting because a lot of mentees don't necessarily think that they have much to offer, and feel very much in the student role. And how have you, like, did you start off with that at the beginning, where when you approach the mentors, you think of how you can help them be successful? Or was that something that just evolved, where over the years you toggled between mentor and mentee?
I think it's an evolution. because I wasn't thinking that way. But then I would find myself so grateful for something that they had done or said that you just felt like you had to repay them. For one of them, I actually was able to offer him a job when he could not find a job elsewhere. He had problems with mental illness, mm-hmm. and he could not find a job, and I offered him a job. And other people criticized me for that. They said, you know, he's not pulling his weight. He causes this problem and that problem. And I just said, I owe him this, and put up with the problems that he was causing. So. Mm-hmm. But it develops over time, and it's out of gratitude. It's not something I thought of at the beginning.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, as you talk about the things that you can teach graduate students and the things that you cannot. You know, gratitude is learned, but it's also partly innate. You know, it's interesting that the role that that's played in building those relationships.
That's right. Some of these things, you know, we often think that empathy cannot be taught, that that's something mm-hmm. internal. My wife used to teach preschool for many years, and one year for Martin Luther King Day, she organized a table so that when kids were fighting with each other, they had to sit down at that table and they had to figure out their solution before they could get back to what the class was doing. And of course, they wanted to get back to what the class was doing, and they were able to figure it out. But the key was, what do you think he thinks about what you just did? And then ask this other person. You force empathy by forcing them to think of, what did this mean to the other person? And it then increases the chance that they can come to a solution fast.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though you didn't have a clearly outlined life plan, it seems you developed your life philosophy and your interest in global health when you were a teenager, I mean, very young. For people who are trainees, how would you guide them to developing life philosophy? Because I think a lot of people struggle with that, probably more now. I think there are a lot of people who even graduate from college and may not necessarily have direction with their life philosophy. What are ways that you think people can find within themselves that philosophy?
25% of graduates in the United States say they had a mentor, which means 75% didn't. Mm-hmm. And I think mentors turn out to be an important way of transmitting civilization. And therefore, they're very important in transmitting philosophy. So it's another reason why we have to have mentors. But to your question, this is part of suggesting become a generalist and find out as much as you can about the world. I mean, why was Rousseau so against the church that he was able to write things that just made other people rise up against the church in France? And why at the end did he seek absolution after having done? I mean, he had a life philosophy, but he wasn't sure of it at the end. Isn't that interesting that he was so strong that he could influence other people, but he wasn't totally sure? It's like Mother Teresa, the things you read now in retrospect that you never would have guessed when she was working in India that she had any doubts about what she was doing. She had doubts all the time about what she was doing. So it's important to read as much as possible and see how much trouble other people have in coming up with a philosophy. And so you shouldn't get discouraged. It takes real time and effort to figure out what's important in your life. What is it that you wish you had done? And when I gave the commencement address at Emory a few years ago, I talked about that we had a person at CDC who went into a coma, but just before that, he asked someone to write his obituary, and then he ended up fine the next day for months. And he said that the greatest joy he had was not in going back to conversations, but in editing his obituary. And I said to the graduates, you will edit your obituary every day. Get up in the morning and know today you're editing your obituary. With it, that makes it a little compulsive to come up with a philosophy if you're going to be. What is it you want to be able to say about yourself when you die?
Yes, and do you think those need to be in abstract terms? You know, like you mentioned, when people are pushed in your class to think about what's more important to them, they come up with relationships, health, freedom. Do you think that's more important to think through as a guiding path than the concrete that, whatever, I want to reach this milestone in my career by the time I'm 30, or that milestone by the time I'm whatever age?
Absolutely, because you use those decisions then to come up with what will I do professionally. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just very basic. And it's the sort of thing, it would be fun to do this in high school and in junior high. I've done this now with all of, with three of our four grandchildren who are old enough to participate in this sort of thing. And what intrigues me is how they got into it. I mean, they really did get into it. They wanted to know this or that. They asked questions. And so it's the sort of thing we should be doing at junior high level, I think.
Yeah. When you look back on your own career, are there things that stand out as the things that you're most grateful for, and maybe certain things that you wish you had done differently?
There are always things that you wish you had done differently, that you had been better at this or that, that you were more skilled in this or that. And people ask me sometimes, are you proud of the things that you've done? And my answer is no, that I'm happy with the things, and that's quite a bit different than being proud with the things that I've done. But my wife and I talk about this every once in a while, about what we would do if we could do it over, how we would improve on what we've done. So you end up with regrets.
It's so interesting, you know, because objectively, obviously, as outsider looking in, you know, all I could think about is your accomplishments and all the ways you've changed public health and people's lives. And, you know, I guess for all our worst critics.
Absolutely. I mean, my wife will tell you that no one is harder on me than I am.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And in the process of making decisions, you know, you were, you know, the director of the CDC at such a transitional time where it became evident that we needed to address chronic disease and we needed to have sound epidemiologic ways of tracking your surveillance. So there was so much growth during the time you were there. When you were in the process of the decision making, you know, the things that we take for granted now about the organizational structure of the CDC is this is the way it is. I mean, you were making those fundamental decisions as it was happening. What was that thought process like? Like, did you second guess? Did you think, oh, I hope this works? You know, I'm sure there's a lot of anxiety that goes with that.
There's a certain amount of distress. That's true. What I did first thing was to send out letters to everyone I could think of, the state health officers, the deans of schools of public health, the deans of medical schools, and so forth, and ask the question, what do you think we should be doing that we're not doing? And then we had an outside committee look through their answers. We had someone that organized them all into different categories, looked through their answers, with one person on the committee from CDC, Don Millar, so that they would have a direct connection. If they had questions, they could get them answered at CDC. And interestingly, one of the first things that came up was they didn't know how to compare a death at 65 to a death at 5. And that's when we came up with the idea of premature mm-hmm. deaths. And then we had a big debate on what should be premature. Well, logically, from a mathematical point of view, you might well use the mean. But if you do that, it changes every year, and you're in impossible mathematics then to compare one year with the next. So it would have been logical to choose age 75, and any death before that was premature. But most of the global statistics use 65, and so that's what we decided to use, and we stuck with that. But that was a very important thing, because that group then came back with their suggestions on 12 priorities that they said, every time you come up with a budget, make sure you've done these 12 things. We then had two retreats at Berry College, where the top supervisors at CDC got together for 2 days each time, going over what this group had recommended, to ask, can we agree on that? Because if we can't agree on it, then we've got internal problems. We not only agreed on the 12, but we came up with three additional ones. So now we had 15 things. Now that's very important. As you're doing your budget each year, you have some guidelines that these are so important, you can't ignore them. And this I found helpful. Then we also each year had a category of the programs could come in with suggestions on things that they would like to see added to their programs. And what they found is they were more likely to be heard if three different programs had joined together. And so we were developing ties across CDC. When I started there, a management consultant said, this is a great mom and pop operation, but you're getting so big, it won't last forever. And it was true. If we went out on an outbreak, we had to come up with a new structure each time, because you would have some people that were had expertise in infectious diseases, some in laboratory, some in statistics, but you had to come up with a new group of people each time. We decided we're going to have categories: infectious diseases, chronic diseases, occupational health, environmental health. And in each of those, we'll have all of the components needed, the statisticians, the epidemiologists, and so forth. You still have problems sometimes not knowing if something is infectious or toxic. And that's what happened with Legionnaires' disease, that we did not know at the beginning what we were dealing with. So you still have to come up with some manipulation of management. But it became much better and efficient, and that's pretty much what has happened since then.
As I'm listening to this, what's so striking to me is the leadership behind building coalitions. You know, I think there are so many different styles of approaching that, you know, and the investment in getting people aligned, it takes a lot of time and effort. I think we see a lot of people bypassing those steps in different leadership styles and, you know, to very different outcomes. So, you know, seeing the success that you had and your approach, you know, it really speaks a lot to the value of the time you've invested in building those coalitions.
We don't do anything without a coalition. And I point that out to students. Even their education is the result of just an enormous coalition that involves millions of people to make their education possible. But one thing we have learned that I did not know at the beginning, there is a difference between the most effective coalitions and the average coalitions. And I think we now pretty much understand what the difference is. And it's important to know this, because leadership now is found not in a title. It's found in a person that can make a coalition work. And the things that seem to work is, don't start from the point of view that we're interested in this problem or interested in that. Start from the point of view that you define your last mile. If anyone signs into the coalition, they know where they're headed. They know what the last mile is. And once you've done that, then you can decide what's the next step. So the first step is the last mile. The second step is the second step. So that's one thing. We've also learned that ego suppression is just absolutely essential. That's where organizations get into trouble. People trying to get turf. Our grandson just this last year went to help develop a clinic in Nepal. And he wrote me a letter saying, you know, they only had 5 or 6 people on this team, but he said, I can't understand it. They're trying to get turf from each other. And for what? You know. So coming up with ego suppression techniques. This means coming up with ways of rewards where the reward is given for what the group actually does rather than the amount of turf anyone has. It requires a different look at management, because the best coalition managers have a combination of executive skills and congressional skills. They know when to make a decision. They know when to get everybody on board. So we've learned something about coalition building, and running a clinic, doing anything, it's always a coalition, and making that fun so that people like to come to work. There's nothing worse than having people come to work who don't want to be there. This last year, when I was at the Gates Foundation for their annual meeting, Bill Gates interviewed me for a half hour, but his last question was, how do you remain optimistic? With so many things always happening, how do you remain optimistic? And I said, the key thing I've learned is there are times when you need pessimists, and when you need that, contract out for it, but don't hire those people. Do not get them on your staff. They'll ruin your day. They'll ruin the day for the entire office. Contract out.
What a great lesson. Dr. Fahey, you've been so generous with your time and with all of the insights that you've shared. I want to close by just asking you if there's anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to share.
I think what we already talked about, which is that we have a healthcare system in this country that spends more money but doesn't have the outcomes of 23 other countries. And there's something wrong with a country that keeps saying, it's okay, we've got the best healthcare system in the world, and we don't. And how do we get that across to politicians and to industry? We believe so much in the marketplace that Ron Paul once said H1N1 is so complicated it shouldn't be left to health people. It should be settled by the marketplace. And this was said just 2 years after the marketplace showed it couldn't even take care of itself. And we went into that great depression. So we should be smart enough to be able to say, this isn't working. The marketplace makes profit the bottom line, and when profit is the bottom line, you can't make quality and other things. You can't make equity or equality the bottom line. And we should be smart enough to do this, and we just have not been able to figure out how to do that.
Well, I know public health may not get thank yous, but I can't thank you enough for the contributions that you've made to just the global health, not just the health of our nation. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.